So this morning we did the festival ceremony, the festival memorial ceremony for Great Master Houn Jiu, the founder of our temple. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why Buddhists make kind of a big deal about their teachers and about lineage and about the Buddha and all of that. Why do we make a big deal about that? There's a word that appears a lot in Buddhism, in the classical text, samsara. And that word means, has a kind of variety of meanings, but basically it's like the cycle of birth and death. And this idea of samsara is that we're kind of stuck in this cycle of birth and death. Sometimes it's referred to as the ocean of samsara. And there are various kinds of images that you might encounter in commentaries and descriptions. Sort of like the ocean of samsara is like churning with impermanence and birth and death. Have storms and whatnot that come along in the ocean of samsara. It's a difficult place. And we're kind of stuck there. And so the Dharma is referred to as a raft, which helps us to cross the sea of samsara, the sea of birth and death, and to break through the cycle of birth and death. For myself, before encountering the Dharma, life seemed pretty dismal and confusing and distressing. And in some way, by connecting with the Dharma and living people who practice the Dharma, it began to make sense of my own life and mind, began to make sense of the world. It gave me a way to kind of figure out what was going on in the world, what was going on in life, what was going on in my mind. And as I put the teachings into practice and began to see what it was really about, what the Dharma was really about, and to understand what my mind was doing, it helped me it began to be clear that it was a great way for me to make it through life and not get kind of drowned in the sea of, in this kind of churning sea of impermanence and disappointment and distress. Other phrase comes to mind. I feel like in some sense, because I encountered the Dharma and good teachers and good friends, I sort of dodged a bullet. In some sense, I literally think it saved my life. And in one way, Reverend Master Jiu Kennett is, well, I didn't know her very well. I've met her a couple of times. Didn't really have any personal relationship with her to speak of. But I did, as a young person, take on board her teaching and practice and put her teachings into practice for myself and prove that it was reliable, prove that it was something that I could trust and that I could use to help me in my life. Again, I didn't have a personal relationship with her, and so what I'm talking about isn't about her as a personality, but as her as a teacher, as someone who practiced the Dharma herself, who learned about the Dharma, put it into practice, and proved it true for herself. On this morning's altar, there are three pictures for this morning's altar, and we often call today Founder's Day. And those three pictures are, the main one is Reverend Master Jiu in a formal pose in front of the main altar at Shasta Abbey. And she's looking quite imposing and in her kind of fancy robes and looking the authority. In another of the pictures that are on the altar, there's a pair of pictures together, and one of them is River Master Jiu as a young person, a young woman, 36 years old, when she met and was ordained by Sekhem Singh, a Chinese monk in Malaysia. And the third picture and the second part of that pair is a picture of Koho Zenji, her transmission master, her true master, her the teacher who trained her how to be a Zen priest, a Zen monk, and certified her as a Zen master. So I wanted to give that, in putting those pictures there, I wanted to give that sense of River Master Jiu was as we are now. She was just a regular person, troubled. In her autobiography, she writes, "When I went to the East, I was an angry young woman, wondering why there was war and hatred and injustice in the world, why these things were out there." She was a person just like us. She grew up and was a young person during World War II, during the famine afterwards, during the hardship afterwards. Wasn't exactly famine in the UK, but was quite tight in Europe, quite a difficult period. So she was a young person like us. She encountered Koho Zenji, her teacher in England, when he was visiting. He invited her to Japan to train and practice there. She had already been interested in the Buddha Dharma and was practicing in her way in England. But she saw an opportunity there, and so she traveled to the East. On the way, she was ordained in Malaysia by a Chinese monk, but then went on to Japan. So she encountered a person who was a teacher and who practiced the Dharma, who understood what the Dharma meant, and who understood how to practice the Dharma. And again, I think she probably didn't have much of a personal relationship with him. She describes a relationship that she had that was quite important to her in her autobiography. But it wasn't about a relationship one person to another so much as it was about a student looking for a way to deal with samsara, looking for a way to deal with the sea of birth and death, looking for a way to deal with her own mind. In her autobiography, she goes on to say, as I said, she says, "I was an angry young woman wondering why there was war and hatred and injustice in the world. The question I should have been asking myself was, why am I as I am? Why is there war and hatred and anger in me? And what can I do about that?" And that's what I learned how to answer when I was in the East. So we start off and we think, why is the world as it is? And then the Buddha kind of kindly says, turn around, look at your own mind, see what your mind is doing, and then you will understand more clearly. Now, what the teachers do, what the great masters do, what the Buddha did, what Bodhidharma did, what Dogen did, what Koho Zenji did, what River Master Jiu did, was not become something, some transcendent being, not become something other than a human being. She learned how to see through the unreality of the world. She learned how to see through what was going on, to see clearly, and to see through to the heart of the matter, and to see what was truly important. And part of that seeing through is understanding that one of the kind of characteristics, somebody said to me recently, I saw somebody who I hadn't seen for a while, and they said, "So what's new in Buddhism?" And then they kind of laughed and said, "Oh, there's nothing new in Buddhism." And And that's, I've had to laugh and think, oh, yeah, that's true. You know, there really isn't anything new in Buddhism. Although the appearance of things has shifted and changed dramatically since the time of Shakyamuni Buddha. But the nature of the world has not. The nature of the functioning of greed, hate, and delusion has not changed. The nature of enlightenment has not changed. The way to find perfect peace has not changed. And so the appearance of things, in other words, has shifted and changed and is constantly shifting and changing. It's constantly moving about and taking on different forms. And while we can't completely ignore that, that's not what we mean by its unreality, it is completely impermanent and can't be relied upon. There's a line in one of the scriptures that we sing about Shakyamuni Buddha, and it says he has many great attributes, and upon him mankind may rely. And the reason that we can rely on him isn't because of any characteristic as a human being that he has. Although he was a wonderful man, I understand, kind, honorable, strong, intelligent, all of those things, that isn't why we can rely upon him. We can rely upon him because he saw through samsara. He sees through the unreality of things. He sees through to the heart of the matter and goes there and can help us to see through the heart of things. Again, it's very helpful that he was such an honorable man and kind and skillful and good and compassionate and all of those things. Those are all excellent qualities. I'm not saying that they aren't. But the real thing that we can rely upon him about is that he saw through things, saw through the appearance of things. And when we understand that characteristic, then we can accept that our teachers are human beings, and we can not be thrown awry by that. When the Buddha, after he awoke, after he experienced enlightenment, and this is the perfect enlightenment of a Buddha, not just the small awakening that we might have as modern-day trainees, but the perfect enlightenment of the Buddha, he continued to carry his alms bowl and wear his robes, do his meditation and practice for the rest of his life. 40-odd years later, he was still doing those things. He was still training and practicing. So an aspect of what we awaken to is the perception that as we go through samsara, as we live in samsara, it is an expression of our own kind of need to continue to practice. And all of the ancestors and masters from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha down to us are people who understand, no matter what their awakening is, they understand the necessity to continue to practice. One day I was in Atlanta with visiting a friend, and they had invited me there to go and hear the Dalai Lama speak. And I had seen him before and seen him do this thing, but I was really, again, just completely impressed with him. And the thing that really got me again and again is the first that he comes out, we're in this auditorium, there's like 5 or 10,000 people in this auditorium waiting to hear him speak. The first thing he does is come out and do 3 bows to the Buddha, to the image of the Buddha on the altar. So basically what he's saying to us is kind of saying, you know, There's a great line in one of the movie where somebody's actually talking to the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama is a young man, and he says, "Well, what do you think, what do you think, Reverend Sir?" To one of his teachers, and his teacher says, "Oh, I'm just a bug, Holy One, just a bug. You have to make this decision for yourself." And in some way, the Dalai Lama has that kind of attitude. I'm just a bug. I'm going to pay my reverence to the Three Treasures. I'm going to keep doing my practice. Dogen says, it is hard to maintain the initial humility till the end. We might have some kind of awakening, and we think, wow, look at me, I'm great, look at my awakening. And it may be a real thing, it may be a real awakening, we can help people from that. But it's so easy to turn that into a little bit of self and make that into a thing, like, look at me. And in the subtlest way. So all of the teachers from the time of Shakyamuni Buddha down to now, the characteristic that I admire most is that characteristic of continuing to be willing to practice, to be continuing to be willing to listen and hear, to, as River Master Jiyu taught, stand up straight in the presence of the Buddha and ancestors and take the consequences for their actions, to continue to learn, to continue to be training and practicing, to continue to wear the robe, carry the bowl, do the meditation. And Reverend Master Jiyu was that person. She did that thing all the way to the end of her life. And it happens that I did happen to know her at the end of her life and knew that that was, I could see that that was going on as a novice living in her monastery. I could see that she was doing her training and practice. Even while being that person in the formal robes with the authority and the voice of thunder at times, she was continuing to do her practice. She used to say, it is more difficult to follow a live master than it is to follow a dead one.
Yeah.
And that point is pretty important to remember. And in some sense, why I try to, my own teacher is effectively dead. He's separated himself from the order and gone a different way. So in my own case, I take refuge in the Sangha of teachers that I have at Shasta Abbey and in the order. We just had a visit from Reverend Master Daishin and Reverend Enya, his disciple. And Reverend Master Daishin was the chief cook at Shasta Abbey when I first went there as a novice. And I worked with him every day as a novice. And, you know, he kind of could see me every day come in, and I'm sure he understood me and all that stuff. And when he's here, try to be as transparent as I can and kind of tell him what's going on. And it's a different situation now. I'm a senior monk, a teacher myself, and in charge of the temple. In fact, when he was here the first time, I had to kind of sit him down and say, "Oh, gee, if you're going to be here, be nice if you could call me and let me know what you're going to be doing. You know, if you say you're going to come at this time," because he was up back and forth at the hospital. And that was a kind of an awkward conversation because, like I say, he was my teacher, one of my teachers. He was real gracious about it, and it was not a problem, but there it is. So things get more complicated as we go along, but still, he's senior to me, and I try to take refuge in him when I can, and in the other senior teachers when I can. It is difficult to follow a live master. So part of what I'm trying to do on a day like today is keep alive the sense of the reality of those teachers who went before, to keep alive the sense of Reverend Master Jiyu, to keep alive the sense of Shakyamuni Buddha, to understand them as real human beings and not some kind of idealized sort of special beings who were in the past. They were real human beings. One of the last things I remember seeing of Reverend Master Jiyu, she had a number of little talks that she did right in the last year of her life. And one day she came to the, we had tea with the monks on a Sunday afternoon after a ceremony like this. And it was our practice to just get together in the shuryo, this room down the lower part of the property at Shasta Abbey. And we'd all get together and have tea, and Reverend Master Jiyu would come over and we'd just talk about stuff, be sort of informal. So we got together, and there were probably 35 or 40 monks there at the time. Many of her senior disciples had come. They knew that she was getting toward the end of her life. So it was quite a packed room. We're kind of sitting there for a while. There's a fire going, and it's kind of hot, and we're sitting there waiting. Nobody's got tea. We're just sort of talking a little bit to ourselves. And finally she comes over, and she wheels in. She's in a wheelchair at that point. She comes in, and she comes in and sits down, and her chaplains come in. There's like four or five assistants that come in, and they all kind of come in a line. They sit down, and she has a look of somebody who's not real happy. And the prior is sitting next to her, Reverend Echo, and she just kind of lets into him about getting the calendar. She apologizes to the monks in the room, "Sorry, I'm late," and then she says to Reverend Echo, she just really lights into him about the importance of giving her a copy of the calendar. She's kind of mad. She's just mad. She lets him have it. And because he had forgotten to give her the calendar and let her know what the schedule was and all that stuff. And he he sat there and took it and said, "Okay, Reverend Master, I'm sorry. I'll do better in the future." And she let it go, and that was it, and then we had tea. And as she's sitting there talking, I'm thinking, there's a couple ways you could go with that. You could think, "Oh, she's a Zen master. She shouldn't be all upset about this." But happily, I didn't think that. I just sat there and thought, "Wow, okay, here it is. She's teaching. It's her responsibility to teach him. He is her disciple. Her responsibility to teach him, to help him to become a better prior, to do a better job. But more than that, here is this person, an old person. She's lost use of her legs. She relies on people to get her up and so she can use the bathroom. You know, they have to like lift her onto a commode chair or give her a bedpan or change her diapers or whatever it is. She lives in this kind of life of kind of great indignity. In some sense, she's trapped in her old age. So on one level, there's the great Zen master who's giving the teaching, you know, be sure to give the abbot the schedule. On the other hand, here's this old lady who's kind of uncomfortable and cranky and letting us know what that's like, what it's like to be that person. And on the other hand, there's just this human being, just being just a human being. All of those things don't get in the way of each other. Don't stand in the way of a problem. I thought it was a kind of a great teaching. And it really helped me to understand that all of the respect and gestures of respect and gratitude that we give to our teachers are really just ways of treating fellow human beings who are worthy of respect. She was just an old lady who was worthy of respect and kindness. There is a line in the Sandokai, depending yet non-depending both. This goes to the point of Reverend Echo, who was a Zen master in his own right at that time, who was had lay disciples. He had his own monastic disciples. Actually, he had ordained me by that time, and I was his monastic disciple. He was, you know, fully capable of just getting on with his practice and training. We have this relationship with our teachers and with the Dharma where we practice the Dharma and we find freedom, we find perfect peace, we find independence. But we continue to also understand, and it goes back to that point about Shakyamuni Buddha carrying his begging bowl and his wearing his robe. We also understand that we are dependent on doing the practice. Always we're depending and non-depending both at the same time. We have freedom, and that freedom arises in part because we're able to do practice. We're not attached to doing practice. We just recognize that that is part of how we are can maintain our freedom and how we is an expression of our freedom. And part of that practice is continuing to bow to our teachers, to be able to say, have the humility to say, wow, okay, I blew it. I accept this teaching that the circumstances give us. So, that's what I have to say about teachers and students. I hope that made some sense. Do you have anything to add to that or questions about that?
I find particularly in this day and age of getting caught up with a lot of samsara drama that comes at you daily, and trying to deal with that, and what came to me is you can almost feel like you're drowning in it. It's really a sense that, and it seems so unreal in a way, and surreal in a way. And the other day I just said, you know, newspaper over here, not too much of that, not too much of this. What do I need to focus on here?
Yeah.
Where's the door to reality?
Yeah.
Because it seems like you're in unreality in a real sense. And in a way, that's a blessing, I think.
You know? Yeah.
Because good luck if you think that is reality. And so, and I think it all has to do with fall. You know, I find going into fall, well, it's time to get your act together, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I can't exist on fun and games here. Let's get to work, you know. But also, it just came to me that where's that door?
Yeah.
Where's that door to reality? And
yeah.
And I feel blessed that it's there. I know it's there. It's just up to me
to go through
to access it.
Yeah.
And so I feel fortunate in that regard, because not everybody is necessarily able to see that door.
Yeah. There's a thing, you know, that I find helpful to remember, which is that the Buddha did not attempt. He renounced the world and lived as a monk, but he did not attempt to separate the monks and himself from the regular kind of run of society. He insisted that the monks always only live on alms. That's what carrying the alms bowl means. He set it up so that the monks were always dependent on the people around them, on the lay people around them, to provide their material support. He tried to make sure that the monks were modest and didn't overburden the people around him, but he always made it clear that, in some sense, the monks were always in the midst of the world. And to me, that's a great teaching in the sense that, okay, where you can find that door to reality in the midst of all of that stuff that you described. You can find your own groundedness in the midst of the world. And in some way, that's the teaching of this temple, which sits here on its little busy street. We are totally dependent on alms. We just are here in our quiet way with our door open. We wait for people to come through if they wish, and practice if they wish, never kind of insisting upon it, or I won't say never, but mostly not insisting on it. And that door, if we choose to look for it, is there and always accessible to us. And in some way, our effort in the practice, our continuing to show up, continues to remind us of the importance of that. I remember at one point, and that point about the reality, I remember at one point, there was a monk who became, honestly, he had a psychotic break, I think, at Shasta, unfortunately. And he became quite erratic and was doing some just really strange things at a certain point. And eventually we had to get a restraining order and keep him away from the monastery. And at a certain point, as all this is transpiring, we're all trying to make sense of it. We're at a tea, and Reverend Master Jiu said, I just have a strong sense of the unreality of the thing. And it was kind of this... Of the unreality of the thing.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it was kind of this just throwaway comment, but somehow it stuck in my mind, and I mentioned it to another one of the senior teachers at the Abbey at the time, and he said, yeah, that's a kind of deep teaching there. I thought about it, and I thought, oh, yeah. Because she's kind of pointing out, okay, here's this thing we have to deal with, to find a way to compassionately deal with this person, and accept what he's doing and work with it and restrain him from doing it if we can. But there is also this kind of quality of unreality about it. And if we can kind of keep that in mind to a certain extent, then we can begin to develop our own way of seeing through the kind of turbulence of life. We can never get away from it as long as we're human beings. And have bodies and need to deal with things. But we can begin to see in a bigger way, see the world in a bigger, from a bigger perspective, and understand that it is, has that phantasmagorical kind of quality to it, which is, has an unreality to it.
I read that samsara and nirvana, that nirvana is samsara, and that it's just your perspective. And if that's the case, then is the bodhisattva making a deliberate decision to not see something?
No. The bodhisattva is making the deliberate choice to accept the truth of that and not try to get away from the samsaric aspect of existence. A bodhisattva, we normally think of that, we normally think that the important thing about a bodhisattva is his foregoing enlightenment to save all sentient beings. But that's we should say that that's the important part about that is the willingness to forego enlightenment to save all sentient beings. I don't think I have ever encountered someone who kind of deliberately said, okay, here's the opportunity to awaken to the reality of life and I'm going to not do it. But so what a bodhisattva is doing is training and practicing in their life with that willingness. And that willingness changes everything. Mm-hmm. It means I'm willing to let go of even the desire to become enlightened, to get away from suffering. And when we let go of that desire, then we stop pushing, stop being in conflict with the reality of life. And that stopping to push is one of the ways that precipitates us into seeing through the unreality of things. If that makes sense.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah. If you're like me, then it will make sense for now, and then we'll have to, kind of have to remind myself of that in the future. Yeah,
because I think it's made sense once before.
right. It just doesn't make logical sense that Reverend Master Jiu taught and other teachers have taught, you know, all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. All acceptance is the entryway into reality. And all acceptance doesn't have anything to do with saying what's going on is okay or I like it or anything like that. It's just literally not resisting it, not fighting against it, accepting it. Here it is. This is what's here. Then asking, from that place, that's the beginning, that's the key, that's the start. From that place of acceptance, we can then go, okay, well, what's next? How do we respond? What do we do? And it leaves it up to us.
I have a question that's less philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
And more historical, but how is, I guess in the era of, thinking about impermanence and thinking about how the world moves and changes and, even the Buddha kind of adjusted his teachings and stuff to his audience and context. After Reverend Master's death, it's been, 22 years or so, how has the order changed?
Well,
I didn't know it was that hard of a question.
It kind of depends on what you mean. One of the things about, okay, let's take it this way. So again, what I was talking about this morning is, what I've been talking about this morning is, why is the teacher important? And what we have tried to, what Reverend Master Jiu tried to do, there's a line in one of the scriptures we recited today called, that goes, "And to the source kept true as an unsullied stream is clear." And what she tried to do in her life is, one way we can talk about practice is that we awaken to the true source of things. We awaken to the deep Buddha nature of things. And we keep true to that. Our method of awakening is all about a practice and a tradition and has specific things in it. And so that's why you have the Dharma transmission and the whole kind of order of Buddhist contemplatives set up to kind of preserve and certify a kind of practice and a way of teaching and practicing. So she inherited, she learned how to practice in Japan and inherited her teachers. She was transmitted by Koho Zenji. She received the Dharma from him. And we happen to be esoterically in what's called the Monzon line of Soto Zen in Japan. And you can trace our teachers and masters, that whole kind of lineage through Manzan, back through Tetsu Gikai and all those people, Keizan and all that. And so that line has a particular flavor, a particular way of doing things. And like in Soto Zen in Japan, and when she was there, there's two major lines of Soto Zen, the Manzan and the Gasan line. And they have different, slightly different flavors to them. And she learned that tradition and practice and inherited it from her teacher. And so like the scriptures that we recite are all kind of part of that. And the translations that we use are translations that other monks in that line made in Japan, and she refined and were approved by her teacher. And so we use them now. And he encouraged her to, her teacher encouraged her to, as he said in a number of places, take care of his Western disciples, and to encourage her to put the teaching into a form that Westerners could take. So there's this process going on all along where we're trying to have the core of the teaching and the practice, and then adapt how we give expression to that for different people at different times. And so I guess maybe the it's a, maybe not very a helpful response, but the thing that I could say is we have made every effort to keep true to that source, both to the source of Buddha nature and both to the and to the source of our practice, our way to find Buddha nature in the tradition that we have inherited. I think to myself, in the temple and the way the temple goes and the things that I do, I think, I hope that if Dogen were to walk through the door, he would see a practice of the Dharma that we're all doing together, me as a monk and you all as lay people, that he would recognize, even if he didn't, even if the details weren't exactly the way he saw it. Or if Manzan walked through the door, he would recognize the practice. Or if Koho Zenji walked through the door, he would recognize the practice. Or if Reverend Master Jiu walked through the door, she would recognize the practice. So I, for myself, I can only say the way that I have adapted the practice is to really try to identify the kind of core of the practice and to see what I know from my own experience I need to, I used for myself to the extent that I have tame my own mind. And I'm trying to pass that on and teach that to people. But also I have to have a fair bit of humility and kind of recognize that I don't, the Dharma that I have inherited is much greater than I understand. I don't understand everything that's been passed on to me. So I'm trying to really be careful not to throw out any kind of aspect of practice that may help. And I wrote a little bit about this in the newsletter recently about making gassho. Making gassho is a thing that I have just, I can't tell you how many times I've been corrected on how I make gassho, particularly when I was a novice. I can't tell you how many times one of the monastic instructors would stop and say, oh no, you make gassho like this. And I'd be like, I don't know what I was doing, but no, like this. And I'd get kind of again and again. And for various reasons, I'm got problems with authority and blah, blah, blah. So, well, it's like 20 years later, I'm making gassho and really doing my best. I'm a senior, nobody's been correcting me very much lately, or at least not overtly. And I'm making gassho and I realized, oh, wait, there's a thing about this that I didn't fully appreciate before, which is that it moves energy in a particular way when we make gassho. And there's actually a kind of block in there for me. And it it helps me to make gassho on that energetic level in the proper way that I didn't see before. And all that time before, I was like, oh, what's the big deal? If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, oh, wait, there is, it's not a big deal, but it is a subtle thing that is quite helpful. Mm-hmm. And just things like that over time have made me think, okay, I have to be pretty careful about the tradition and the way we do things. That said, I talk about the Dharma in a completely different way than she did. Mm-hmm. I see some things that went on when I was a lay person that don't really sit that well with people. And so I try to avoid that, and other monks have noticed that too. We have gotten a bad rap for complicated reasons. When you were a lay person in the early days, when you come to a temple, you would kind of be treated as a novice monk all the time. And you might have been practicing for like 15 years with us, and you'd still get treated like a novice monk as a lay person. And that just doesn't, it's just not, this just doesn't work. And honestly, she didn't treat people that way, but just because of the way things get transmitted and the way practice goes. So I really try to make sure that I don't treat lay people like that. You see what I'm saying? And that, again, is not just me, but other monks perceive that. So I guess maybe that's about the best I can say.
Well, I guess I was thinking along those lines. You know, the traditions and the core teaching and persists, but how it's displayed or maybe discussed or explained changes from, as you said, I mean, you talk about the Dharma a little differently than she did. But that doesn't mean it's incorrect. It's just you have to tailor it to who you are and your understanding to who we are.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, and if
you're not beating us. You know, I didn't see that at Shasta, so yeah.
Right. That's one of the changes that happened from that she made bringing it from Japan. No, we don't hit people with a stick anymore. If you go to Throssell, or Master Daishin Morgan, who was, you know, transmitted, certified as a master, all of that kind of stuff, had the full support of her Master Jiu Kennett. He teaches in a significantly different way than she did, and doesn't teach certain things that she taught. But still the kind of core of the practice is there, and he isn't like repudiating what she taught. He's just saying, well, this doesn't make sense to me, so I'm not going to talk about it. If that makes sense.
I'm reminded, true to the source, the fact that the scriptures we do, like this morning, can be traced back. You know, it's not like we did, you know, you decided, or the Abbey decided, well, we'll do this and throw that out. You know, that sort of selectiveness, you know, it's not there.
Yeah.
There's that true to the source. And Sandokai, Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi, and Scripture of Great Wisdom. And I was reading some Cultivating the Empty Field. It has a little bit of history in there from, you know, and I'm reading, and of course, Scripture of Great Wisdom is maybe first century, I don't know. And I'm going along, and then here's the 8th century and the Chinese, and there's the writers of, they were doing the Most Excellent Mirror Samadhi and Sandokai. And I don't often get that kind of historical connection. You know, we do the ancestral line and you get that sense, but that reality, that scripture written in the 8th century, those two scriptures actually, coming down, you know, and true to the source.
Yeah.
And what an anchor that is.
Yeah.
In not very, you know, keeping things on the tracks, you know.
Yeah.
And there was just this sense, I don't have too much historical sense in me, but I had that sense that this long lineage that I'm able to
rely on
and express and put into, you know, practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is important to, I find it comforting to recognize that too. Some of the scriptures that we recite are quite old. They've been used in Zen temples for hundreds and hundreds of years. I find that to be quite comforting. Mm-hmm. But to also recognize that, like, San Dokai is a poem written by a Chinese Zen master. So it wasn't around when the Buddha was teaching. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something the Buddha said. But it was something that came from his practice, from his understanding, and so we had adapted it, and it helps us today. So there is that kind of going back and forth, and part of the thing about the tradition is that it's been in some ways proven to work over all those centuries. So it's like slow. We try to be slow to change the Dharma aspect of it, but we do change it sometimes. Like recently, we started doing. And I found myself reciting the scriptures this morning with the feminine pronouns. We recently changed the Avalokiteshvara scripture and the whatnot to feminine pronouns, and that was a thing that she didn't have. She didn't see a need for at her time, but seems like a good idea now. So, see how that goes. All right then. Thank you all for coming today. I think to call it good. Really good to see you all.